As we get started this morning, I just want to say I can hardly believe that this is already our last week in the book of Chronicles. When we started this book, we're still early in COVID, and I don't think any of us imagined that we would be in this season this long. And yet here we are, after 6 weeks in Esther, a couple weeks in the Psalms, a week in 1 John, and 14 weeks in 1 Chronicles. And COVID is still a thing that is looming, hovering over our lives, affecting us in a variety of ways. And it's been interesting as we get closer and closer to Election Day, just how timely Chronicles has felt. Someone just asked me the other day if I picked Chronicles for this time, in preparation for the election, and I didn't. This is just the way the schedule worked out as we mapped out a plan to work through the whole of the scriptures, which makes it fascinating the way that God leads his church through the scriptures, often in unexpected ways, bringing us to just what we need in the moment when we need it. And I am convinced that as we finish Chronicles this week, that God has something for us to hear, a word for this moment. And I've been praying for us that we might be open to whatever God has for us. So I hope you're with me this morning. And I want to set up our passage by sharing something that I thought was pretty cool. Earlier this week, I was watching this video about the structure and the design of the television show Lost. And in this video, they showed this really cool, pretty short clip. It was the very first scene and the very last scene of the entire 6-season series, and they were side by side. And this video was showing how the very last scene of the whole show was identical, shot by shot, to the first scene, just in reverse. The very first shot of the whole show is an eye-opening, and the very last shot is that same eye closing in the same place, in the middle of this bamboo forest, next to the same dog. Life and death, beginning and end. The full clip is pretty cool. The creators of Lost are often described as creative geniuses, not only for their work on Lost, but in all of their work. They both show this ability to tell a complete story, paying attention to its design, the design of the story, the structure of the story. What's interesting about this to me is that this very same structure and design that makes people sit back in awe of a work of art like Lost also exists within our Bibles. This morning, as we are finishing the book of Chronicles, we find ourselves right in the middle of one of the Bible's central design patterns. Just like the end of Lost, shot for shot, reversing the beginning of the show, Chronicles is doing the exact same thing, scene by scene. We're watching the story of a nation come to an end, in reverse order of the way it came into being. In Chronicles 34, Josiah the king and the Israelites rid the land of all of its pagan idols. Then a priest of God finds the Torah of God's law, and the priest gives it to the people. And then the priest leads the people in making a covenant with their God. In chapter 35, then the people celebrate the Passover. Immediately, Judah's king is killed by the Egyptians, and all of God's people weep and they lament. And then in chapter 36, the king's son is taken as a slave to Egypt, and from that point forward, Israel ceases to exist as a nation. Remember that in the Hebrew Bible, our first testament, the book of Chronicles is the very last book. It's the end of the scriptures. And if we can remember that, we will see the design pattern. Chronicles is coming to a close. The Hebrew Bible is ending. The story of Israel as a nation is coming to an end. And we hear this story as a reverse Exodus. The book of Exodus, the second book in the Bible, tells the story of this nation being born. And Chronicles tells the story of the nation's death. Remember, try to recall the story of the Exodus. God's people are slaves in Egypt. But God unleashes a plague on Egypt, the death of every firstborn son. And only those with the blood of the Lamb on their doors are passed over by the angel of the Lord. The first Passover. This epic celebration of God's victory. And as Israel fled from Egypt, they sang and they danced and they celebrated all that God had done. And then they came to this mountain where God gave them Torah, his instructions, and the people made a covenant with God. And then God brought them into the land where they were to clear the land of every pagan influence. Can you hear it? The end of Chronicles retelling this story, but in reverse. By the end of Chronicles, God's people have come full circle. They are back, like, as the Proverbs say, a dog returning to his vomit. They have returned to their slavery. They've gone from promised land to back into Egypt. Miraculous victories in the Exodus story have been replaced by tragic losses. Celebration has become lament. Joy has turned into mourning. God's gift of instruction has been lost or misplaced. The Passover is reduced to a formula. We won't be able to dig into all of the details this morning, but let me just encourage you to check it out this week for yourself. Read through the Exodus and you'll hear the story of Israel's birth as a nation. And then read these chapters again and you'll see that nation coming to its tragic end. One of the things that you'll notice is that both stories revolve around the Passover. And this is the design feature that I want you to see this morning. Whenever you see a similar event described in Scripture in two different places, it's on purpose. And it's only by looking at both events that you can begin to tell what a single event means. Real quick, let me give you some examples. Each of the four Gospels tell the same story of the life, ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus. But it's in the differences in the ways that each writer tells their story that gives us some insight and some sense as to what each writer is trying to communicate with their Gospel. Even then, within the Gospels, Mark tells the story of two different crowd feedings. So Jesus feeds a crowd of 5,000, and then he goes on to feed a crowd of 4,000. For years, people questioned why Mark thought it was necessary to tell this second story, where Jesus goes and feeds less people than the first time. It seems like a little anticlimactic if Jesus has already fed 5,000 and now he's just feeding 4,000. But if you notice the differences in the stories, it starts to become clear that Mark has an important point that he is making and that both stories work together. In Exodus and in Numbers, we're given two stories about God providing water for the Israelites through Moses as they're wandering through the wilderness and they're thirsty. And these stories are almost identical, except they aren't. There are differences, and it's in those differences that we begin to see the design and the intention behind those stories. And we realize that they stand as individual stories, but together they say something else. And so here we are at the end of Chronicles. In chapter 35, we have this massive celebration of the Passover. Chronicles devotes almost an entire chapter to it. And it describes it like this in chapter 35, verse 18. We read, "No Passover like it had been kept in Israel since the days of Samuel the prophet. None of the kings of Israel had kept such a Passover as was kept by Josiah." Literally, two verses later, Josiah ignores a command from God. And Josiah leads an army into battle against some Egyptians. The same Egyptians that God defeated during the original Passover. And Josiah dies. Josiah goes above and beyond to celebrate Passover. And then, just like that, he dies. Chapter 35 is fascinating in the way that it describes Josiah's Passover. Notice in verse 4 how Josiah instructs the people. "Prepare yourselves," he says, "as prescribed in the writing of David, king of Israel, and the document of Solomon, his son." See, Josiah isn't simply winging this celebration. He's following the script that he has been given. And notice what Josiah commands in verse 6. "Slaughter the Passover lamb and consecrate yourselves and prepare for your brothers to do according to the word of the Lord by Moses." In verse 10, the priests and Levites stand in their places according to the king's commands. In verse 12, the priests and the Levites set aside the burnt offerings so that they might be offered to the Lord as it is written in the book of Moses. In verse 13, they roast the lamb with fire according to the rule. So that in verse 16, this is all summarized as being done according to the command of King Josiah. If you go back and you reread the story of the first Passover, you might find yourself a little bit confused, because over and over you'll hear Moses saying things like, this day will be a memorial for you. You shall keep this feast to the Lord throughout the generations as a statute forever. Do the things I am commanding you. And so Josiah does the things that Moses commands. And yet here, Josiah appears to keep the Passover to the letter of the law. He follows every statute from Moses, from David, and from Solomon. Josiah is the epitome of the micromanaging executive, making sure he pulls off the best and most perfect Passover ever. And Chronicles tells us there is literally no Passover like it since the time of the judges. Which leaves us wondering, like, what has gone wrong for Josiah and God's people that this ends in Josiah's death and the people's exile return to slavery? Well, this Passover is part of a larger design pattern in the Bible. And by following that design, I think that we can find some answers. See, not only does Josiah's Passover make a perfect bookend framing the story of Israel as a nation, it also stands in contrast to the Passover led by King Hezekiah more than 50 years earlier. Remember what I said just a few minutes ago, that anytime a similar event shows up in two different places in Scripture, you can read them in light of each other, notice what is different, and get a better sense of what's happening in both of them individually and as a story. So Josiah leads Judah and celebrating the Passover in chapter 35. But just five chapters earlier, more than 50 years before Josiah, King Hezekiah led Judah and Israel in a Passover of his own. All of chapter 30 is devoted to telling Hezekiah's story. And we're told in verse 26, "For since the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, there had been nothing like this in Jerusalem." This is fascinating. right? Many of you know the book of Chronicles overlaps with the book of Kings. Both books tell us some stories of Judah's kings. And in both books, Hezekiah and Josiah get significant attention. But in the book of Kings, we're never told about Hezekiah's Passover. And in Kings, Josiah's Passover just gets a couple verses, which tells us something, that the author of Chronicles, writing many years later, lifts up these stories, gives them significant space in his book because he thinks that these two Passovers are an important part of Judah's story. Hezekiah is described as being unlike anything in Jerusalem since Solomon. And then Josiah is described just a few chapters later, 50 plus years later, as unique since the time of Samuel the prophet. And so we're left to ask, like, what is the difference? Why give two whole chapters to these Passover celebrations? Well, I haven't exactly told you everything you need to know about Hezekiah's Passover yet. Hezekiah's Passover isn't unique simply because he observes it. We're told that it is the joy in Jerusalem that is unique. In chapter 30, we actually read this emphasis on joy several times. We read in one place that there is great joy in Jerusalem. We're told that the whole assembly in Judah, the whole assembly from Israel that has traveled down, and all of the foreigners living among them rejoiced because of the Passover. They decided to keep the festival going for 7 extra days, giving thanks to the Lord and celebrating with gladness. And before that, they celebrated for 7 full days with great gladness, praising the Lord day by day, singing with all of their might to the Lord. Their 7-day celebration turned into 14 days of celebration, and the city of Jerusalem is overflowing with joy and gratitude and gladness. Now read through Josiah's story in chapter 35 and you will notice a massive omission. There is no joy. There's no gladness. There is no singing. There is no praise. There is no thanks being given anywhere. Read it and you'll notice the major difference between the two Passovers is that Hezekiah's results in real worship with incredible joy. The people, they turn their lives toward God as they tear down their idols. And when threatened by a foreign army, Hezekiah lives according to the spirit of the Passover. He trusts the God that rescued Israel from slavery in Egypt. And so Hezekiah prays to the God of the Passover for deliverance when they face enemy threat. But Josiah's Passover simply happens because he declared it would. People do all of the things that Josiah commands. They follow all of the rules. And in chapter 35, verse 19, we read this summary. This Passover was kept. Cool. But in the very next verse, Josiah gets nervous about an Egyptian army that's not even coming after them. But Josiah takes an army to go fight them anyway, and he dies. And we're told that all of Judah is left weeping and mourning. We're told that the city of Jerusalem is filled with lament. The singers who were supposed to lead the people to sing praises and gladness and joy and thanks are left singing laments. Why? Why would Hezekiah's Passover spark celebration and worship and Josiah's lead to death and lament? There's one other detail that is different about these two Passovers. Chapter 35 makes it clear from the very first verse that Josiah's Passover is very different than Hezekiah's. Why? Because Josiah keeps it on the 14th day of the first month, the day that Israel was commanded to observe it. Hezekiah? Let's just say Hezekiah was herding cats, as the saying goes. We discover pretty quick in his chapter that neither the priests nor the people really had their act together when Hezekiah announces that the people should observe the Passover. In chapter 30, we learn there aren't enough priests who have kept themselves holy to actually serve the Passover, and the people just didn't show up. And so, rather than celebrate the Passover during the first month, they held it off to the second month. And this gave Hezekiah plenty of time to send letters throughout the country. And this letter included a passionate appeal and invitation to come to the Passover, but more than just come and observe a holy day. It was a call. These letters had a call for the people to return to their Lord. In verse 9, Hezekiah writes to his people, "For the Lord your God is gracious and merciful." Sound familiar? "And will not turn his face away from you if you return to him." For Hezekiah, he's not interested in performing a ritual because it's a good thing to do or even because it's been commanded. Hezekiah is interested in the God who commanded the ritual. And Hezekiah remembers that the God of the Passover is gracious and merciful. Celebrating the Passover is a chance to remember this God and to enter into this story of God's grace and mercy. This God who longs to be in relationship with his people, and the Passover is an invitation to return to the Lord by remembering the Lord. And so, some sinners who had been far from God for a long time come. They turn from their ways and they respond to the invitation that Hezekiah offers. And this is where the story gets super interesting, because verse 18 describes the condition of the people who've come and are eating the Passover, right? They were unclean. And notice this, especially in light of Josiah's intense commitment and to going by the book of preparing the priests and the worshipers and getting them clean beforehand. In Hezekiah's Passover, we're told many of them ate the Passover otherwise than as prescribed. Chronicles comes to a close with a tale of two Passovers. This is how the whole Hebrew Bible comes to a close, and then the New Testament opens with its own tale of two Passovers. You see, Jesus gathers with his disciples in an upper room to celebrate the Passover with him, a meal he has longed to eat with them. Like Hezekiah, Jesus offered the invitation. John the Baptist showed up announcing it first, but then Jesus continued the call. Return to God. Repent. And people followed. Not everyone followed, but some did. And this group was filled with people who were unclean. There were sinners, and there were tax collectors and prostitutes, and there were the sick and the poor. And at the same time, the rest of Jerusalem was celebrating the Passover in the spirit of Josiah, led by the Pharisees and religious leaders. The people in Jerusalem believed that if they could celebrate the Passover perfectly, according to the law, God would return and would restore the kingdom to Israel. At one table in Jerusalem, unclean people are sitting with their God, experiencing his generous love and abundant grace. And at another table, or at every other table, people are following the rules to a T, but they've missed the God of the Passover in their midst. And within 24 hours, these Passover observers will be yelling, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" They will kill God's king. And Jerusalem will be filled with mourning and lament, just as it was after Josiah's Passover. Of one last detail to tell you about Hezekiah's Passover, and it should bring Jesus' final meal alive in a beautiful way. Hezekiah didn't ignore the uncleanness of those who came to his Passover. He didn't just go, well, whatever. God says it's not okay, so and blew it off. We're told that Hezekiah prayed for them. See, the Passover was a reminder that Israel had been claimed, chosen, saved by a certain kind of God, a God who was unlike the gods of the nations. Hezekiah knew what this God was like, and so he prayed, saying, "May the good Lord pardon everyone who sets his heart to seek God, the Lord, the God of his fathers, even though not according to the sanctuary's rules of cleanness." This is incredible. And Chronicles tells us God is exactly who Hezekiah thought he was. God is exactly who God declared himself to be on Mount Sinai and in the Passover. That God is a God who is eager to forgive iniquity, sin, and wickedness. God is eager to be restored in relationship with not only his people, but the whole world. This is who God is. Hezekiah knows this, and he prays to this God. And we read, "The Lord heard Hezekiah and healed the people." As we come to the Gospels and the story of Jesus, we see this tale of two Passovers on full display. Right, there is one Passover taking place that is obsessed with just getting it right, making everyone as clean as possible, making sure everything is followed to the letter, and excluding anything or anyone that is unclean that could harm the Passover and prevent God from returning. And then there is a Passover where Jesus, God in the flesh, is present, praying for the unclean people who are eating with him. And he prays like this. Just like Hezekiah, longing for their healing. Jesus is present at a Passover where he takes a bowl and a towel and he washes the dirty feet of those with him, and he says, "Go and do likewise." Jesus is present at a Passover where he takes bread and a cup and he orients the people to the heart of this meal, saying, "Do this in remembrance of me." Don't simply do it. Remember me. Let who I am shape you and set you on your path as you leave this table. See, the meal is an invitation to draw near to God through Jesus, to see God in Jesus, to never forget who God is or what God is like. This meal is an invitation to repent and to turn and to offer a seat at the table to any who would come and be forgiven and healed by our God. This, in contrast to Josiah's Passover, They go through all of the right motions, but there is no remembrance. At least not in a way that results in joy. The joy of knowing you're saved and loved. There's no remembrance that changes the way that Josiah lives. There's no remembrance that would keep the people of Jerusalem from murdering their own God the very next day. In Josiah's Passover, the rich are free to eat all of the food while the poor go hungry. The powerful are free to devour widows' houses. As long as you follow all of the ceremonial rules and pray the right prayers. In Josiah's Passover, you can exclude the foreigner from the table, or the unclean, or the poor, or whomever you want, rather than praying for their healing. You celebrate the Passover by thanking God that you're not like them. In Josiah's Passover, you can leave the table and then take up arms to defend yourself. You can leave the table and then go attend a public lynching. You can leave the table and do injustice. You can leave the table and fear the liberals or fear the conservatives. You can observe the Passover without ever encountering the living God. Josiah's Passover is marked by slavish obedience to the letter. And that always takes us right back into slavery to sin. But Jesus's Passover is marked by the obedience of faith, an obedience that comes with an encounter of the living God that has experienced the healing power of forgiveness, an obedience that knows grace, that didn't require you to get cleaned up or be obedient before you came to the table. But an obedience that flows out of the truest experience of knowing that you have been loved. A love that comes only from God. As Paul said, it is the letter that kills, but the spirit that gives life. Paul was summarizing a tale of two Passovers. Will you seek and know and draw near to the Jesus who is our Passover? I pray that you would this week.